Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 1 of For the Record Program number 720, Overview of the Pan-Turkist Movement. This program is being recorded on August 1st of the year 2010. We're going to jump back in time to January 14th, 1986, and we're going to listen to a section of AFA program number 14, the first of two long archive shows about the World Anti-Communist League. And specifically, we're going to be talking about the history of the Pan-Turkist Movement. In weeks to come, we're going to be talking about a number of things dealing with the Earth Island, that stretch of land going from the Atlantic Ocean, Portugal and Spain, all the way across Europe, all the way across Russia, the former Soviet Union, and China, India, Pakistan. It involves the Earth Island, that is, as it was termed by geopoliticians, involves most of the world's landmass, most of the world's population, most of the world's mineral resources, including and especially oil. And across the middle of that is a vast stretch of Muslim population, and many strategists, European colonial strategists and others, had seen utilizing that Muslim population as an ally as a great way of achieving world domination by controlling the Earth Island. There's a very important book that we're going to be dealing with in the not-too-distant future. It's called A Mosque in Munich. It's authored by Ian Johnson, a Wall Street Journal writer. It's subtitled Nazis, the CIA, and the Rise of the Muslim Brotherhood in the West. And we're going to be taking a look at overlaps between the Pan-Turkist movement and Third Reich geopolitics, in which they attempted to use the Muslim population of the former Soviet Union in order to help defeat and then break up the former Soviet Union. We're going to be hearing names like Theodor Oberlander, a German minister of Expellee and an Einsatzgruppenführer. He basically helped to lead mobile killing squads on the Eastern Front. He then became a German minister and a key element of the International Committee for the Defense of Christian Culture. He also had much to do with setting the stage for the use of Muslim populations as Cold War weapons. And we're going to be coming back to Theodor Oberlander when we deal with a mosque in Munich. Also, the name Ruzi Nazar, Nazarov, another name that we actually looked at him in For the Record program 549, and we're going to be coming back to Ruzi Nazar in our discussions with a mosque in Munich as well. We're going to be talking about things as seemingly disparate as the recent Russian spy, that is in future broadcasts, things as seemingly disparate as the recent Russian spy scandal, which broke right after a diplomatic rapprochement between the U.S. and Russia. We're going to be taking a look at the flotilla incident. We're going to be taking a look at elements in Turkey that appear to be angling for something of a renaissance for the Ottoman Empire. And there are areas of interaction between these various dynamics. However, first, we're going to come to understand the Pan-Turkist movement, and we're going to take a look at the Promethean League, which was something like a pre-Wackle, so to speak, a pre-World Anti-Communist League, the Promethean League grew up in Poland under Marshal Pilsudski, basically a fascist himself. And then the Promethean League, also financed by the French and British intelligence services, ultimately jumped to the Third Reich itself. In addition to my own voice, you will also hear the voice of my very charming and capable former co-host, Nip Tuck, who assisted me with the on-air responsibilities. So here is a section of AFA number 14 from January 14th, 1986.
One of the groups, which one of the peoples in the 20th century who have been affected by an irredentist movement, so to speak, by basically a longing for bygone days of empire, are the Turks. Of course, the Ottoman Turks built a very, very powerful empire encompassing much of Europe during the Middle Ages and just before. And the Turks, although in the 20th century their power was largely eclipsed, there remained among the Turkish people not only a strong longing on the parts of certain people for empire, but also because many, many ethnic Turks lie outside of modern Turkey, there was a strong nationalist movement among the so-called outside Turks, people of Turkish extraction who live outside the borders of modern Turkey. Now, this Pan-Turkist movement has been very, very strong in the 20th century, and because many of the Turk-ik speaking peoples lie inside the boundaries of the modern Soviet Union, Pan-Turkism took a largely anti-Soviet character in its attempt to unite all Turkic speaking peoples into one national entity. The Pan-Turkist movement has sought the return of many of the Turkic-speaking areas of the Soviet Union as part of a greater Turkey. And this pan-Turkist movement is one of the things that we're going to be looking at, and its incorporation into the ABN. This will be cropping up later in future broadcasts, in particular in the background of the shooting of the Pope. We're not going to look at that specifically this evening, but we are going to look at the pan-Turkist movement as part of German fascism and even before, and we're going to see how that became incorporated into the ABN.
Now, recalling again fascist Poland under Marshal Pilsudski and its aspirations to regain part of the Soviet Union, one of the things that Marshal Pilsudski set up was something called the Prometheus Organization, okay, the name for the Greek god who brought fire to man, supposedly, the Greek Titan, I should say. And the Prometheus Organization was basically, as the researcher, by the way, credit for all of the information on the pan-Turkist movement here, including the Prometheus Organization, goes to a fabulous researcher in the East. And when these people were actually two researchers, and when they were explaining this to me, they characterized the Prometheus movement as sort of a pre-wackle wackle, at least with regard to its European and Eurasian components. It basically was just that. It was sort of an anti-Soviet group which was composed largely of various nationalist groups inside the Soviet Union and sought to break up the Soviet Union and defeat the Soviet government in that way. It was not only anti-Soviet, but anti-communist and explicitly fascist in its outlook, although many of the people involved with it were nationalists, and the anti-communism and fascism were secondary if they were of any importance at all to them. However, the organization itself, as we're going to see, began cooperating with the Third Reich, which made good use of pan-Turkist elements. Following information about the Prometheus Network, this pre-wackle-wackle based in Pilsudski's Poland, which involved pan-Turkist elements to a considerable extent, information on this comes from a book called Pan-Turkism in Turkey, subtitled A Study of Irredentism, was authored by Jacob Landau, L-A-N-D-A-U, published in London by C. Hurst & Company. I don't know the date offhand. And Landau writes of the Prometheus Network as follows. Speaking of the period just before World War II, during this period, several periodicals of pan-Turk character were published in Europe. Most were issued regularly, probably because of the expenses involved, but there were two exceptions. Turan Mekumasi, published in Budapest, and Prometheus, an anti-Soviet journal originating in Poland. And of Prometheus, skipping down, Landau writes, and talking here about something which we needn't concern ourselves with, which is pan-Turanic journals here and so forth. It was evident that it's not important to pay attention to that, but leading into discussion of the Prometheus Network, it was evident that the Turan Society and its publications constituted an expression of the isolation felt by the Hungarians in what appeared to them as a hostile environment, as well as a manifestation of their search for potential allies. To a great extent, this was also the feeling of those Polish circles which published the other long-term interwar periodical, Prometheus. This was the organ of the Promethean League, a semi-clandestine, anti-Soviet association established and sponsored by President Pilsudski, the Polish Ministry for Foreign Affairs, and the General Staff as an umbrella organization to provide financial assistance and political coordination for anti-communist governments in exile. All those who had suffered at the hands of the Soviets were considered as their natural allies against the Soviet peril. Among these, the outside Turks held a prominent position. The association's bulletin, Prometheus, Organe de Défense des Nationales des Peuples du Caucase et de l'Ukraine, was published monthly in Paris from November of 1926 to April of 1938. Note here that in addition to the outside Turks, Ukrainian nationalists were very prominent in Prometheus. Continuing, Turkestan was subsequently added to its masthead, and the publication was ultimately named Prometheus, Organe de Défense des Nationales des Peuples of the USSR. Well-known pan-Turkists such as Rezul Zad, Mirza Bala, and others contributed articles about the strong sentiments for independence and for a pan-Turk union in Azerbaijan, the Caucasus, and Turkestan. Polish financial aid to pan-Turkist organizations may well have continued even during the Second World War. This subject, however, lies beyond the scope of our immediate concern. What does not lie outside of the scope of our immediate concern, though, is that the anti-Soviet aspirations of the pan-Turkists and other elements, the Ukrainians of the Promethean League, were to find expression in the Third Reich.
Now, this next section is from a book called Turkism and the Soviets, And the book is by Charles Warren Hostler, Colonel, U.S. Air Force. And it's published 1957 by George Allen and Unwin Limited of London.
It's also worth noting that some of the people who helped, this guy was an Air Force colonel who did a lot of research on this stuff, and there's an interesting note there.
And as we get into this, the segment we're reading itself, you'll notice a kind of a slightly interesting tone to some of the comments the man makes about these Turkish connections to the Third Reich. And one of the things, you may remember a name from the first article that we read, he talks about Hostler in his foreword, mentions, how does he put it? Okay, here, returning from Turkey in 1950, I was assigned to the U.S. Air Force's Farsighted Graduate Training Program at Georgetown University. Okay. In this period, I had the good fortune to become associated with Dr. Stefan T. Passani, who guided me in writing a shorter study, The Pan-Turanian Appeal, et cetera, et cetera. And he thanks Passani again at the end. Now, Passani, again, is a figure of the far right affiliated with WACL, as we mentioned in the first article.
And a member of the WACCFL steering committee that we just looked at with Messrs. Kramer and Guyland.
And a bigwig at our own local Hoover Institution, as well as his affiliation with Georgetown. Georgetown, of course, we've talked about a great deal because of its involvement in a whole variety of right-wing politics, and it's basically, among other things, it's a journalist factory for the right wing. And we talked about Claire Sterling, Michael Ledeen, Arno de Borgrav, etc., etc. Claire Sterling, Michael Ledeen, again, particularly interesting because of the fact that, as Dave mentioned, the pan-Turkish movement comes in very strongly into the assassination attempt on the Pope. And here we have this other connection to Georgetown, to Passani, and things like that, of people writing about these same groups also, and also being affiliated with the World Anti-Communist League. So that's something we'll probably get into at a later point. Anyway, I'm going to read a little bit from Turkism and the Soviets by Charles Warren Hostler, USAF and Georgetown graduate. The pan-Turkist irredentists regarded as inevitable the defeat of the USSR and considered possible the creation of a confederation of all the Turkish peoples of Soviet Russia and Chinese Turkestan under the Turkish Republic's leadership. In general, Soviet sources are in accord with the Western ones on this question, and Miller, in his Ocherki Noveshi Histori Turci, begins the story of German-Turkish collaboration with a period preceding the outbreak of the German-Soviet War. Four days prior to the German attack on the Soviets on July 18, 1941, the Turkish-German Pact of Friendship and Non-Aggression was signed. In the interval from 1941 to 1942, the Turkish press openly assailed the Soviets. There were indications of increased Turkish preparation to take part in events and to arrange Caucasian and other Turkish areas independently or with German concurrence. In the autumn of 1942, the Turks concentrated troops at the Caucasian border, anticipating the fall of Stalingrad. The anti-Soviet campaign of the Turkish press had then reached its zenith. One may conclude that highly placed persons in the Turkish state had plans ready to exploit all the possibilities the German-Soviet war and a collapse of the USSR could furnish for the realization of pan-Turkish ideals. The outbreak of the war in June 1941 aroused great hopes among the Turco-Tatar leaders scattered in the West and in Turkey. Nearly all of these leaders approached the Germans and supplied them with various aid memoirs, documents, etc. The Germans also sought contacts and the exchange of opinions. Veli Kajum Khan, one of the chief followers of Mustafa Chokai, also Kokaylo or Chokayev, a leader of the Turkestanis, we'll just call him Mustafa Chokai, a leader of the Turkestanis, was in touch with the Germans and had given them pertinent facts on Turkestan. He insisted that Turkestan should not become part of any future Russian Federation. Mehmet Emin Rezulzadeh, the head of the Azerbaijan Musavat Party, went to Bucharest after the occupation of Poland in 1939. He sent an exhaustive report to the Germans and subsequently went to Berlin. The Promethean leaders, who were living in Warsaw during the German occupation, also supplied the Germans with material.
Noting there, a continuation of anti-Soviet policy from the Promethean organization originally under Polish sponsorship a continuity of action to the Third Reich.
Ayas Ishaki and Syed Shamil, leaders of the Kazan Tatars and North Caucasians respectively, also went to Berlin. The Crimean Turks were represented in Berlin by Mustagib Fazil and Edige Kiremal, mentioned above in the letter from General, well, we don't care about that, and several Turkish politicians and unofficial representatives, including ex-General Erkilet, traveled there, several Turkish politicians and unofficial representatives, including ex-General Erkilet, traveled there or visited the front lines. Edige Kiremal and other Turco-Tatar leaders were permitted by the Germans to visit the occupied portions of the Turco-Tatar regions of the Soviet Union, namely Crimea and the Northern Caucasus. A most important political and military aspect of World War II pan-Turkist activity involved the national military units formed of Turks from the Soviet Union, who fought in the German armed forces against the Soviets. The idea of forming these units originated with two prominent Turks, Mustafa Çokay and Veli Kajum Khan. Mustafa Çokay died in December 1941, but German-educated Kajum Khan became commissioner for Turkestan, together with the other commissioners for Azerbaijan, Volga, Ural, Caucasus, and Crimea, who were appointed by the German Ostministerium, Ministry for Occupied Eastern Territories. The idea of using the Turks of the USSR in the fight against the Soviets must have been readily accepted by the German High Command, whose approach to such problems were purely utilitarian. There was probably no serious Nazi political opposition to this idea, as the territories inhabited by the Turks of the USSR lay in general outside the limits of planned direct expansion of the Reich.
I would interrupt that this is wishful thinking on his part. In fact, one of the key people that we're going to look at, Theodor Oberland, now this is sort of an aside, who was actually imprisoned in a concentration camp for a short time for proposing the use of these various Turkic nationalities as allies of the Third Reich. After a while, the German losses forced a reconsideration of that position. But initially, they were pure Aryans, and so they were actually scornful. Although they would use them, they would not grant them equal ally status. And so that's actually sort of not an accurate statement on his part here.
The Germans needed military security and combat replacements. The receptiveness of the Turkish prisoners of war to the proposal stemmed in part from their political and religious convictions. The Wehrmacht was aware of their propaganda influence on other Soviet troops of Turk background and also of their political potential of diminishing enemy resistance, achieving speedy pacification of occupied territory, and making allies out of these populations. The overwhelming majority of the Turk volunteers were recruited from among Soviet prisoners of war captured by the Germans. The 162nd Infantry Division, commanded by General Oskar von Niedermayer, a well-known German specialist in Middle Eastern affairs, was assigned the task of organizing them into combat battalions. This activity was implemented by Army Group South, which was largely in the central Ukraine area. A top-secret memoir by Rosenberg, that's Albert Rosenberg, concerning his discussion with Hitler on December 14, 1941, indicates by that date, partial Turkization of these units was completed, and the experience was judged successful. On December 30, 1941, the High Command of the Wehrmacht was directed to establish a Turkestan Legion consisting of members of the following nationalities: Turkmens, Uzbeks, Kazakhs, Kyrgyzs, Karakalpaks, and Tajiks. B. Caucasian Mohammedan Legion, composed of Azerbaijanis, Dagestanis, Ingushes, Lezhins, and Chechens; C, a Georgian legion; and D, an Armenian legion.
By the way, Armenia is one of these territories which has sort of got bisected during the imperial period. Half of it's in Russia, half of it's in Turkey. Like Azerbaijan, another area in the Soviet Union, is half in Soviet and half in Iran.
A Volga Tatar legion and a North Caucasian legion were formed in 1942. These legions were training centers where national units were organized and indoctrinated. For each of them, a corresponding national committee existed. The commanding officers of these legions had the disciplinary authority of a commander of an independent battalion. They were subordinate to the commander of the 162nd Infantry Division. The legions received prisoners of war from collecting camps and were charged with training them into future combat battalions. Each Legion headquarters had a permanent cadre of German military personnel and the necessary number of Turks selected by the Legion commander. After completing of their training and political indoctrination, the combat battalions left the 167 Infantry Division for attachment to different active German divisions. During the subsequent war years, the Turks, the Germans grouped the Georgians, Armenians, etc. under this term as well, furnished the rank and file elements of 19 unattached battalions and 24 companies. Among other duties, these units were used for frontline action and for fighting partisans. As early as May 1942, Turk Battalion No. 450 fought valiantly against partisans near Jampol in the Ukraine and dispersed the enemy after suffering 28 casualties. There were only two German officers and two non-commissioned officers attached to this battalion. The post of General der Osttruppen was established in December 1942. It was occupied first by General Helmich and then by General Kestring. As a result of the activities of the Turkestan National Committee, the East Turkish Waffenverband, a Waffen-SS unit, was formed in 1944 of four regiments of two battalions each, one composed of Turks from Turkestan, another of Azerbaijanis, a third one of Volga-Ural Turks, and the fourth of Crimean Tatars. Now, one thing to notice here, just for future reference, because we're not going to need to deal with it too much tonight, but notice the fact, again, as so often happened in these groups, of these groups with whatever their particular gripe was to begin with, getting involved in coming into the Nazi sphere of influence, and then not only having that initial movement in that direction, but then going through official training and indoctrination. And believe me, folks, it seems to stick, and we're going to be talking about that in future broadcasts.
Okay, and again, note the continuity of policy from the various anti-Soviet groups who combined under the Promethean banner in Pilsudski's Poland. Then Prometheus gives assistance during the German occupation to the Nazis. The Pan-Turkists seize upon the Nazis as they're basically their vehicle for the partitioning of the Soviet Union and the adding of the Turkic speaking peoples to a greater Turkey. And note in particular the use of various Turkic minorities in German military units to fight against the USSR. Now again, the anti-Bolshevik nations, or the peoples involved with the anti-Bolshevik nations, became one of the key elements of the Galen spy organization both during World War II and afterward when it jumped to the U.S. Now recall the various Turkic minorities working for the Germans in their military units. Reading a short section now from a book called Galen, Spy of the Century, published in hardcover by Random House, copyright 1971, and authored by a man named E.H. Cookridge. Galen, by the way, was the head of Foreign Armies East. He was Hitler's chief intelligence officer for the Eastern Front, in charge of all intelligence activities in that theater. After the war, he jumped to the United States and then NATO and finally to West Germany with not only his whole organization but with his files intact. So a continuity of intelligence functions from the Third Reich to the United States, to NATO, to modern Germany, and again, all under this man, Reinhard Galen. Now, of some of the activities of Reinhard Galen's Foreign Armies East, and specifically the use of Turkic peoples in military units on the Eastern Front, we're going to encounter a name here who's a key person with regard to the World Anti-Communist League, and we're going to be coming back to him. Reading from Galen's Spy of the Century. From such Caucasian defectors was recruited a battalion, codenamed Bergman, or Minor, which grew to comprise three Georgian, one Azerbaijani, and one Armenian company under the command of Captain Theodor Oberlander. Some of these men went into action in October of 1942 at Terek and Mozduk, collecting 1,600 defectors from a Soviet division whose political commissar was Mikhail Suslov. So again, Theodor Oberlander, a key member of WACL, as we're going to look at shortly, was commanding a battalion composed of Turkic defectors fighting now against the USSR. Now, it's worth noting that the nation of Turkey essentially remained neutral, although they were quite sympathetic to the Axis. They remained neutral until the very end of the war when they came in on the side of the Allies. Now, the Pan-Turkish activists were very, very bitter towards the Turkish government. Obviously, they wanted to bring the Turkish nation in on the side of the Axis as a means for assisting the German victory and for partitioning the Eurasian parts of the Soviet Union. Now, the Turkish government was a little more far-sighted than these individuals. And they basically held the rein in on the Pan-Turkists because they were afraid that the Pan-Turkists might eventually bring them into the war against the Soviet Union. Not that they were particularly enamored of the USSR, but they were afraid of it, and they felt that remaining neutral would be a better path to, for them to pursue in case, as it turned out to be, the USSR won the war, then they would not have an enemy, a huge and powerful enemy on its borders. So because of this reason, because they didn't want to alienate the USSR, and as it turned out that was a far-sighted decision, the Turkish government reins in the Pan-Turkists in Turkey because the Pan-Turkists want to bring Turkey into the war on the side of the Axis. And in 1944, as the fortunes, the military fortunes, were turning very obviously against the Germans and the Pan-Turkists felt that their time was running out, a series of demonstrations broke out in Turkey to attempt to prevail the Turks to come in on the side of the Axis. They were put down, and a key name for our purposes was crops up in connection with these demonstrations.
And we're going to be reading from Jacob Landau's book, Pan-Turkism in Turkey. And the name comes up at the very end, so there'll be a lot of other names before then. Reading from Landau's book, open conflict between Pan-Turkists and the government was thus inevitable. Again, Dave just explained why there's conflict between the government and the Pan-Turkists. The government wishing to remain neutral, the Pan-Turkists not wishing to remain neutral. On the February 20th and March 21st, 1944, respectively, Atsiz published two open letters to Premier Mehmet Sukru Sarkoglu in his monthly Orhun, denouncing subversive activities in Turkey, chiefly those of communists, and demanding more active Turkist, and by inference, Pan-Turkist policy. Several issues of Orhun were confiscated, and the periodical was subsequently closed down. The Pan-Turkists then took to the streets, crossing the critical threshold between ideological propaganda and political action. On May 3, 1944, in defiance of martial law regulations, large anti-communist demonstrations took place in both Istanbul and Ankara to protest against what the demonstrators considered the penetration of communism into Turkey's government bureaucracy and educational system. Pan-Turk slogans were also in evidence, probably inspired by growing anxiety over the fate of Turkic groups in the Soviet Union. The deportation of Tatars and others was then being planned and was in fact carried out a few days later. Such notable Pan-Turkists as Atsiz, Turkan, and others were involved, as well as a young captain, Alparslan Turkesh, who was yet to make his mark in Turkish politics. Now, Alparslan Turkesh, along with a lot of other students and folks, were involved in Alparslan Turkesh is a man whose name we are going to hear a lot more of.
That again from AFA program number 14 from January 14th, 1986. In addition to my own voice, you also heard the voice of my very charming and capable former co-host, Nip Tuck, who assisted me with the on-air responsibilities. This concludes Side 1 of For the Record program number 720, Overview of the Pan-Turkist Movement. This is being recorded on August 1st of the year 2010. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.